I'm here. Welcome to another edition of The Deepest Lore. With a Nescafe Gold today, slightly lukewarm due to the slightly delayed start time here, where we were trying to get everything ready. And today I am joined from Unpopular Opinions by Mr. D. How you doing, D?
I'm doing well. I have my superior brewed organic Sumatra single estate coffee here, prepared in a French press as a gentleman should. Also, I think that, you know, the best way to start the show would be to say, it's The Deepest Lore with our very special guest, John D.
and
Panama Hat.
Yeah, I'm also joined by Panama Hat.
Hello, everybody.
So, how are you doing, sir?
I'm absolutely fine. Yes, well, what else can I say? I mean, Mr. D is going into detail on his coffee there because he knows the inferior hipster brew that I have in front of me because I just can't be bothered with coffee.
What is your hipster brew?
It's a Irish liqueur flavored instant coffee, and don't send me hate mail because my Twitter account is no longer working.
Is it Littles, Panama Hat?
I'd have to go and get the actual jar and look because I didn't pay that much attention.
I think it might be that Littles coffee. I quite like that.
It's a small jar with a white and green label.
Yeah, it's Littles. Yeah, a Cardiff special. Okay.
Oh.
So. Some people may be surprised that we are doing a show called The Muppet Show today, and we're not talking about politics because The Deepest Lore is your oasis of calm away from all of the chaos of the modern world, as it were. It's like a bubble. It's a safe space, D, if you want, for non-political chat. So we have decided to travel all the way back to the mid-70s for the original Muppet Show, which ran, I believe, from, was it 1976 to 1981? Is that right?
Yes, the 5th of September 1976 to the 23rd of May 1981.
So, yes, and so you guys, for the past few weeks or months, have been doing something called Muppet Mornings, is that right? Why don't you explain to me what this is all about?
Hat, do you want to take this or do you?
Right. Well, so this really goes all the way back to the start of, well, sort of first quarter of this year when large numbers of people started to gather in the VC of the Deep Lore around sort of between 2 a.m. and 7 a.m. UK time. And at some point, Mr. D and I and some others started to watch a program which you'll probably have heard of, called The Two Fat Ladies with Clarissa Dixon Wright and Jennifer Patterson.
Yeah.
And
Lashings of cream and lard.
Of cream. Don't be afraid of the mayonnaise. And we watched this. We watched three of those episodes a morning. And then we quickly ran out of those because it being a show, you know, a British show, there aren't many of them. And of course, Jennifer Patterson's very tragic death. And then we started to watch The Muppet Show because Mr. D has autocratic tendencies when it comes to the rota of programs. And he decided it was going to be The Muppet Show. And I had never seen The Muppet Show before. And I was hooked pretty quickly.
What's that, Panama Hat? Mr. D, backstage diva tantrums? Never.
It's nothing to do with the diva. Listen, so I am the cultural superior here, obviously. And I'm also the elder of almost everyone in this circle, because I am so painfully old. So, you know, I'm, again, being an artist, I'm a sort of man of culture and who's traveled the world, and being old, I feel it is my mission to sort of educate these feckless zoomers about the ways of the ancient culture that we're quickly losing. What is strange about this is the interest. I mean, there a lot of people were very interested in watching the Two Fat Ladies, and a lot of people have joined us over time to watch The Muppet Show. I will say that I feel like part of the reason that this has worked so well is due to the due to the sad sort of state of us living in this sort of deracinated, locked up purgatory, yes, that we're all in. And so we had to sort of figure out a way to keep ourselves from going insane. And so meeting virtually and sort of watching these programs. I think the Muppet Show, I don't know why I chose it. Like, it just was a whim. I realized that I hadn't watched them, in quite a number of years. And I also felt like it would be sort of a daily white pill. It would be a sort of daily boost in the morning, to sort of keep people's spirits up. It's another world. It is so removed from kind of the realities which we are facing at the moment that it just seemed to be the right choice. So we've watched many of these. The original run was 120 episodes, and we have watched almost 100 of them. We've been nearing the final stretch of watching the entire run.
That's rather incredible. That have not been just to explain. I tend not to go in the VC, as people will know. I only ever post in text form in a little area called General. So I did not join the Muppet Parade, but I have watched a few episodes, by which I mean like a handful, in the past few days, just to refamiliarize myself with it. But I have watched a lot of these before, because they used to I want to say they used to rerun them. I can't remember if it was on ITV or BBC, but they definitely used to show them when I was a kid, reruns of this original run. I'll give it back to Panama Hat to continue his disposition in a second. But might I make an early suggestion as to what the allure of this particular show is, Dee? And that is that every week there is a special guest. And if you look at the list of the guests, one side of the list is like an incredible who's who of like Hollywood stars and people who are like really quite huge stars, from the film world and from the music world and from entertainment in general. And then mixed in with that, you've got, how should we say, other sorts of stars who are almost from like a lost world of light entertainment and you know what I mean, right? They're almost, there's a strange mix of very like A-list stars and then people who were like, well, who is this then? And then you look them up and they were, you know, maybe on some B-tier TV show or something like this.
They were on the up, but they never made it.
Yeah. And now, of course, you have to keep in mind that, again, that this is, I mean, when you look at that guest list, it is the most, I mean, in some ways, it's the most 70s, you know, it's very of its time. And so many of these people were very much kind of 70s, some of these people were sort of 70s phenomena. They're also mostly American, not all of them, of course, but there is a kind of emphasis on American sort of pop culture. So again, some of them will not be familiar to people. And now, of course, I was born and I lived through the era that this show was produced originally. And so I know a lot more of these people than, you know, your average, you know, sort of young person. But even I don't know all of them. I mean, there are quite a number of them that are unfamiliar to me. So I would certainly agree with you, AA, that yes, there are people who certainly have waned from the public light since these heady days.
Yeah, and the other thing that I was going to suggest may be part of the allure. It was part of a period where these stars actually meant something, and they came from a world in which it seemed to mean something to be, you know, like to go to the theater to see a big star, and in many cases that was actually true. Even within the, you know, outside of the weird world of the Muppets, you're still from a world in which this kind of showbiz thing was something that people might get excited about, as opposed to now, where I feel like people just wouldn't care at all, really.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the Muppet Show is a strange example because it's kind of a frame within a frame within a frame, in a way. It is itself, even at the time it was produced, it depicts a kind of tradition, which we'll get into, I'm sure, later. But it depicts a tradition, in fact, very specifically the British music hall tradition, or vaudeville, if you want to make the American
angle.
In
America,
yeah. But it is both, and we'll talk about why the Muppet Show is much more British than people would assume. So it was about an era that had faded away, and there were other sort of things of this type. I mean, very famously in the mid 70s, there's a musical by composer that I think I like, and I think Panama Hat likes him, Stephen Sondheim, called Follies, which was about this. It was about people from this sort of vaudeville era revisiting a theater that's about to be demolished, and so. There is a sense when The Muppets was produced that it was about this sort of disappearing kind of world.
I don't know if you know the play, Dee, but there is a what I would consider to be a reactionary masterpiece by John Osborne called
The Entertainer.
The Entertainer.
Yes.
And in fact, the film version is haunting. It stars Laurence Olivier.
Yes.
And that is about, you know, one of the last of these music hall stars. So that tradition was very much on the way out I think The Entertainer was written in 1960, and it was on the way out back then. So by the time you reach the mid 70s, they're clearly harking back to a world that no longer exists. But it's interesting watching it now, because the world that their world, i.e. the world of the 70 stars, also no longer exists. So it's just kind of interesting postmodern
dual. That's what I was always sort of meant by frame within a frame. It is basically it is about a situation, and it is also itself a situation in which it's the grounding of it has basically fallen away and disappeared. So there is something very sort of curiously poignant about it.
There's a couple of other things I'd mention as well. I mean, these are just my initial observations just watching these past few. I mean, can you guess which ones I beelined to? Because you gave me 15, and I was like, I went through them all, skimming them, and I took down their names, D. But then I was like, right, I wonder which one, I wonder what happened in this one. Can you guess which ones I watched?
How about Panama Hat? What do you want to give it a go?
Oh, I don't know. Well, it's either going to be the likes of sort of Forsythe.
Absolutely.
Roger Moore.
Correct.
Mark Hamill and the Star Wars crew.
Yeah, I did. I didn't watch all of that one, but I did watch like five.
I thought you'd dip into it. Yeah. Perhaps Bob Hope.
Yeah, I did see a bit of the Bob Hope one, but I didn't. Bob Hope's like a very US centric phenomena.
Even though Bob, I will break in and say that Bob Hope is actually British. He was born.
Is
in
he really?
Yes, really? He was born in England.
I also wanted to see the Julie Andrews one. I watched the Elton John one. The reason I watched the Elton John one is because when I was searching around, for some reason, Elton John was a lot of people's pick for like best ever guest or something. For some reason, So I watched that. The last thing I wanted to say before we. Kind of, I give the floor to you two, is you know, this frame within the frame business, it's kind of interesting because it's also the actual show itself is a show within a show. So Kermit is both the compere, but he's also like the kind of backstage manager, like he's kind of running things. And so it's you're watching a production of a production. It's a bit like a bit like a Shakespeare play, like Taming of the Shrew.
Right.
Is a play. The whole play is a play within play. It's actually the dream of that fellow Sly, and he just falls asleep on the side of the stage. Mm. People forget about that framing, right?
Mm.
And Muppet Show is like that, where you get to see them backstage, and they're always rushing to put on the show. So we both watch the show and the backstage, which is kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, it's also, again, it's a stage show. I mean, it's in a theater, and the whole sort of show is about the production of this theatrical evening. But it's also very much a television show, and some of the sketches that we'll talk about later they're very much kind of television sketches. So it exists in this weird space. I mean, it's a television show about a theatrical show that is also a television. I'm now convinced that The Muppet Show is the most postmodern work of art ever produced.
It is quite meta, isn't it?
Very meta, very meta. Now, I want to clear something up before we go further. I am not interested in The Muppets as a franchise.
Yes, very important.
I am of the opinion that the Muppet canon ended with the death of Jim Henson in 1990. I have absolutely no interest in the productions of this franchise after the death of Henson, and certainly not now, because, of course, The Muppet Show, Jim Henson Enterprises, I can't remember what it's called, was swallowed up by the evil mouse some years ago. And they continue to produce Muppet content, but to me, I don't care. I'm not interested in the Muppets as a thing.
It's funny you mentioned that with the evil mouse, because my attitude to Disney is similar. That post the actual man Walt Disney, that's really the kind of start of the end of the Disney being anything of critical cultural significance. Yeah.
And Panama Hat said something interesting recently. You said something about this sort of your idea that the Disney Corporation was is sort of a fundamental evil of our time.
Well, I think that it's probably the corporate cultural block that exists, really. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but they own pretty much all major entertainment, really, don't they? The influence they have is vast. I mean, you're a fan of the Star Wars analogy. I mean, they really are the sort of Death Star, aren't they, in terms of...
Well, I mean, they swallowed up Disney, Star
Wars
itself, right?
that as well.
And this is why it's tragic in a way. I don't want to get too political early on, but these people, Jim Henson, Walt Disney himself, the man, the likes of a George Lucas, they are kind of individual Anglo mavericks, you might say, right? And it's kind of disturbing when you see them just like then. The things they created then get swallowed up by the machine and turned against everything. Like, I mean, can you imagine like actual, 1930s Walt seeing what has become of his beloved creation and the uses to which it is being put? I mean, we've watched in our own lifetimes, George Lucas look on to see his own creation kind of ruined, right?
Well,
in front of his eyes.
I think Lucas is somewhat smug about all that because, of course, the amount of flack he got for the prequels, which are now somewhat sort of beloved, if not sort of, 100% unironically loved among Star Wars fans, it seems.
Yeah, I would like to say I was ahead of the curve on that.
You were there defending them.
And also, I should point out that there's also a very deep connection between George Lucas and The Muppets, which, of course, can you venture a guess, AA?
Well, didn't Jim Henson provide the puppetry for Jabba Hutt's palace and all that?
And even more fundamentally, Yoda, in the original films, and I think in the prequels as well, was performed by Frank Oz, who, of course, was one of the core Muppeteers.
Fozzie, right?
Yeah. Miss Piggy, Animal. I mean, he performed quite a number of the core characters of Muppet Show, and yes, he was the voice and the operator of Yoda. So literally, when you hear Yoda speak, I mean that is the voice of Frank Oz, who of course is the voice of all these other Muppets. So there is a very deep connection there, and Henson was involved in many sort of productions in terms of, things that needed advanced puppeteering, especially in the 80s. Of course, I know one of your favorite films, and a very good film, is Labyrinth, which is entirely a Henson production.
Extremely dear to my heart is The Labyrinth, to the extent where, if you got my soul and distilled it down, probably about 25% of it is that film.
I would just like to reiterate Mr. D's point about the Muppets as a franchise. I have no interest in the whole franchise thing. This him showing me this TV show was something of a revelation, just because it's such an artifact by itself. Like, regardless of the Muppets as a sort of continuum, these are really quite entertaining just on their own in a sort of Simpsons way. That it's ostensibly sort of for children or younger viewers, but when you peel away the outer layer, it's really not. They do touch upon sort of a quote unquote adult themes frequently, but there is a kind of meta humor to it that I think only really adults would get. Although I do slightly disagree with Mr. D's thing about the canon, because I do hold that The Muppets Christmas Carol is just an excellent film by its own merits. And
well, The Muppets Christmas Carol was made during Jim Henson's lifetime. So oh, that's that, right, is, that is canon. Yeah. All of those films, The Muppets Take Manhattan, The Muppet Movie, all of those, Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, those were all Henson productions. So those are in the canon. Yeah.
Do you stretch to The Treasure Island, or does that get booted because he died?
I don't mind it. I mean, it's still made by all of his associates, I think, though I haven't seen it since I was about six, so I don't have
much recollection of it. Yeah, I have not seen it, so I can't comment.
It's a decent, I don't want to talk about it too much, but it's got, what's his name? What's the name of that guy?
Tim Curry.
And
Okay.
there's a pretty good villain performance from Curry, to be honest. So that maybe that you could make that the final, like the full stop, because it's basically his crew, and it was directed by Brian Henson, who is the son of Jim Henson.
Yes, yeah. Henson had I think Henson had five or six children. He had quite a number of children who ran the franchise after his death. I mean, Henson took over the role of Kermit for quite a long time. And then I think Steve Whitmire, who was one of the puppeteers who worked on the original show, took over Kermit after that, and who was sacked. It was recently sacked by Disney. So again, just to show the sort of hollowing out that corporation does to beloved properties. But Brian Henson was he, and I think Henson may still retain the role of CEO of the Henson Corporation. So
the final connection I want to make very quickly between, because you were mentioning the George Lucas Jim Henson connection, the other odd connection that I want to make here, because one of the things I noticed was that the Muppet Show is kind of anarchic, surreal, and at times borders on what I describe as the theater of the absurd. There's a lot of absurdism in the individual skits and things. You know, some of the stuff you're watching is kind of a little bit trippy, you could say. The other connection I wanted to make very quickly is with the Monty Python crew, because those guys, to my knowledge, are one of the few times you get to see like genuine absurdism in kind of mainstream culture. And one of the things people forget about the Labyrinth is that it was written by Terry Jones, who was one of the...
I did not know that Terry Jones wrote Labyrinth.
And that is why, if you watch Labyrinth, there's this streak of very kind of Python-esque humor all the way through it. You know, the walls start talking back, and, you know, oh, I'm just a worm, come inside, meet the missus, and all of that. And that kind of gives the film a great charm, if you want to put it that way. But there's a streak of that I notice running through. There's a kind of connection with like British comedy in a strange way, even though this is a very American thing. And I was wondering if you knew anything more about that. Why was Jim Henson kind of friends with, and Cleese crops up in one of the episodes, I know.
Let me tell you, I mentioned this earlier, is that there is a very deep connection in The Muppet Show with British culture, and British, you know, sort of certainly celebrities of that time. And that is that the entirety of The Muppet Show, that the 1976 to 81 run, was made in England. It was not made in America. It was made at BBC Elstree Centre in Bournemouth. So I think a lot of people don't know that, but it is just as much a British production as an American production. And in fact, several of the puppeteers, you know, the sort of regular puppeteers that worked in the show were British. Certainly the crew was mostly British. There is a very deep connection there. The reason that The Muppets was produced in Britain is because Jim Henson produced a pilot, basically on speculation, of years before The Muppet Show. And the person who took him up on the pilot and said, okay, I am going to fund, you know, the production of a series, was a man called Lew Grade, Baron Grade, who you may have heard of as the founder of ATV, ITV.
I remember him.
And of course he had experience with puppets, with puppet programs, because he was the person who underwrote Gerry Anderson and, you know, Super Marionation and Thunderbirds and all of that. So he'd already had a great success in here in the UK with puppets. So he took a chance on this weird crew of Americans. So all of the Muppet shows were produced under the auspices of ITV and then syndicated elsewhere through that organization. I think ATV was a production company, but it's all sort of part of the same organization. So the Muppet Show is, weirdly enough, a British production, just as much as it is an American sort of idea.
There's a strange British connection with Star Wars, isn't there? A lot of that, like George Lucas did a lot of stuff with British crew and so on and so forth. But one of the strange ways that this creeps into the guest list is that, I mean, literally, right? You go through the list and you're like, okay, you know, so we're dealing with you know, Vincent Price and people like Judy Andrews, Elton John. You know, these are pretty big, Bob, you know, Bob Hope. But then it's like Bruce Forsyth, Leo Sayre. I mean, you know, some of what I mean is some of the names are very kind of, I guess in show business, they'd say like UK market centric. It'd be like, Alan Titchmarsh cropping up or someone like that. You know, it's going to American audiences would be like, who? Leo Sayre,
Bruce Forsyth. Also, Spike Milligan was a guest. You know,
literally, it goes, you know, Sylvester Stallone, Spike Milligan. it's just this curious disjunction between the names, and surely some of that comes down to who was around, who was in London that week. You know, who could they get a short notice? And probably some agent was there okay, we're down to Leo Sayre, let's get him in this week.
Very late in the run, there was a substitution. I think Hat knows a bit more about this than I, so.
Though I would just say on the point of the British stars, now we talked earlier about how this whole show is a tribute to the sort of lost art of the music hall and the variety show. A lot of those British stars, people like Forsyth, had their original theatrical training as music hall performers back when it was still a viable thing. So, I mean, in a way, and it's clear that Henson has a sort of love or a sort of nostalgia for the music hall, because he in many of the episodes, he resurrects these, you don't often hear sort of 70s pop tunes on the Muppets, even when they've got professional performers on that are sort of in the moment. You get these very, very old, you know, sometimes pre sort of, you know, 29 music hall tunes that, you know, that go back a long, long way. And it's not actually clear to me how he dredged up the scores and the lyrics for those songs, especially since many of them are
lost the agent. Well, you're right about that. Yes. And that is something I guess we'll talk about this one if he
the show must
returns.
Go on. Very, very, very Muppetesque, actually. Just have the sort of the host fall through the floor or something.
to explode, get eaten by a monster.
We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the eating.
Don't say
the V word.
No, I'm not going to say the V word. There is a very strong connection to musical repertoire in the Muppet Show. And again, I think this is something AA will want to hear, so perhaps we should wait. Oh, there he is.
He's back.
Sorry, my internet went down. Sorry. Carry on, Panama.
Yes. Where were we? I finished that bit there, and then we talked about
musical.
Where were we?
Yeah. Musical, yes. So as I wanted to say, AA. Yes. I would say like many of the numbers. Like I don't know, at least a third of the numbers that they do on the show, the Muppets themselves, are literally British musical songs from the 19th century and the early 20th century. And then they do a lot of them, like Any Old Lion. And I mean, I should have a list here. I was going to make a list of all the music hall songs that they'd done. But yeah, and so it is odd because a lot of that repertoire would not have been familiar to American audiences. They do vaudeville numbers as well, but less of them. I mean, less Americans with numbers of that period than you would suspect. So that is a great, again, another sort of connection to the British for the show. And I suspect it was not just Henson, but I suspect the music director of the show. The show had a music director and an orchestra and a score every week. Again, something that is sadly lost in contemporary, sort of culture. This idea of producing a live score for each show and having this deep sort of tradition to music, or deep attachment to music.
It's very, very, very interesting. I wonder how much of that was lost to American audiences, or were they being culturally enriched through the covert British imperialism?
They may be, or perhaps both. Speaking of imperialism, there's quite a number of episodes where in the backstage area, where a lot of the action happens, leaning against the kind of balcony of the backstage area, are like flags of the Empire, sort of rolled up, like, but they're clearly visible what they are. But yes, literally flags of the British Empire.
In a couple of episodes, and this is really pushing the envelope out, you know, the flag of the House of Plantagenet. You know, it's bizarre occurrences in this show. I mean, I think Henson must have a soft spot for kind of British nostalgia, but I mean, even most Brits would have a hard time, you know, having a nostalgia for the House of Plantagenet.
So, I don't know how you want to progress with your discussion of this, but I mentioned possibly, you know, naming some of the top characters, but one of the things I notice is that there are particular formulas, aren't there, to like the structure of the show is pretty similar every week. Kermit opens it up. Who is the backstage guy? Is it Scooter?
Scooter, yes. The gopher.
Well, so let's just say that the format was basically the same. There would be a cold open, which is just a term for an opening of a show before the title of the show and the theme is played. And so the cold open was the same for the first four series, which is that it was generally Scooter, who was the kind of gopher of the theater, knocking on the dressing room door of the guest star and saying, 15 seconds to curtain, Miss, you know, Ross. And going in, and then there would be a setup for kind of generally a visual joke, something of the guest star interacting with Muppets. And then there would be the theme song, which changed a few times during the course of the show, which I think most people are quite familiar. And then Kermit would come out and generally do a spiel in front of the theater curtain. Then there would be a song. Either it would be a Muppets, you know, sort of one of their numbers, or it would be the guest star performing whatever they did. And then there would be this series of sketches. There were only a few sort of settings. There were there were scenes in the dressing rooms, often the guest's dressing room. There were scenes backstage, where Kermit's desk is and such. There were scenes at stage right of various people sort of gathered at the edge of the stage, you know, commenting on the action or getting ready to go in. There was a canteen, and so occasionally you would see them in the canteen.
Swedish chef.
Well, that was on the stage. The Swedish chef, yes, was cooked in the canteen occasionally. And that was basically it, you know. And then there would be numbers on the stage. And then there would be, of course, the interactions with the box, with Statler and Waldorf in the box. So it was a very set formula, the show, and didn't really deviate from this for the entire run.
Oh, that's another little hint of postmodernism, of course, is the Statler and Waldorf.
inbuilt hecklers.
Yes, and they are like, you know, there are a few characters who, you know, are in every episode, and they are in every episode of the show. They comment. They also end the show. They provide a stinger at the very end of each show. Yeah. They generally respond to almost every act, every sort of sketch that's done. So they are kind of the chorus, you know, in a way, or the, you know, a kind of breaking the fourth wall, which they also do as well. I mean, there are quite a number of references to puppets and the fact that this is also a puppet show in the course of the few of the episodes. There is a lot of these sort of odd framing devices, but within, again, a very sort of strict format that doesn't deviate.
So did you want to have a look at some of the, like, how do you want to do this? Do you want to focus on this guest stars?
I have a list. I thought we should sort of go over and just talk briefly about some of the characters. I divided them up into characters based on prominence. So I think the first one we should, of course, mention is Kermit the Frog.
Shall I share my screen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
I'd just like to say, I think Mr. D deserves some sort of mention for the effort he's put in to collate this list, because these are all very high-res pictures of the 70s Muppets, which are, we discovered, very, very hard to come by, because, of course... A lot of the media around the Muppets is focused on the post Muppet Show franchise. So
in very few cases, but almost all of these are sourced from the 70s versions of the Muppets. And I try to get, you know, really nice, good images that were explain the characters, So Kermit, I think everyone knows these characters. I mean, the thing is, of course, we're just, you know, I just want to sort of fairly quickly go over this list because, again, everyone is, you know, very familiar with these sort of characters and their personalities and such. Certainly Kermit of all things. So
I just want to say one thing that I always thought was interesting about Kermit is that he was the one... crossover star, wasn't he? Because he was also in Sesame Street as like a roving reporter, as like a street reporter. Any idea why that was? Why was Kermit in both
shows?
Yes,
it's because Jim Henson created several of the characters that had gone to become Muppets for earlier projects. For example, Rolf the dog, who we'll get onto in a minute, originally appeared in a dog food advert. That was the debut of him. So, and that was like 10 years before, well, about 15 years before the Muppet Show was made, a long, long while ago. So that's why the Muppet Show was something of a sort of hodgepodge effort by Jim Henson to create a show that basically wasn't for kids. And it just sort of unexpectedly took off.
Yeah, Kermit was one of the first puppets that Henson made. I mean, the original Kermit, if you look him up, I don't have a picture of him in there, is quite a humble affair. Actually, the original one was made out of an old coat that belonged to Henson's mother. Kermit predated the Muppet Show by quite a bit. He's, I think, from the early 1960s, if not even earlier. I can't recall when Kermit was created.
Do you think it's safe to say... that Kermit is the Mario or the Mickey Mouse or the Ryu of the franchise, if you want to put it that way, of the show.
Yeah, I would say that's a fairly safe bet. The other interesting thing about Kermit is, of course, you know, there is very little between Jim Henson's hand and the audience. In other words, Kermit is a very simple puppet, and he's very much, you know, his facial movements, everything that he does. There's an image in there called Kermit Scrunch Face that you may want to pull up, but Kermit's sort of whole personality, all his expressions are very much very sort of thinly covered version of Jim Henson's hand, you know.
There it is.
So he's also kind of a very elemental Muppets. I mean, many of the other ones, as people know, are much more elaborate. They have much sort of different build styles. But Kermit is very much kind of a primal Muppet, very much about the articulation of Jim Henson's hand.
And again, look at the medieval English flags in the background draping the wall. Look, just to illustrate what we said earlier.
Yeah.
One thing I appreciated in the couple of episodes I watched was the extremely cheesy compare jokes that he'd make.
Mm.
Things like, okay, coming up next, someone who needs no introduction, so why am I here? And they're just kind of thrown out. Like, you don't even have time to kind of react. It's just, it's very subtle kind of, compare humor, if you want to put it that way.
One thing to note about Kermit is that his character, as many of them do, his character changes from the first sort of two runs of the show onwards. Because if in the early episodes, he is sort of this very, not uncaring, but very sort of quite cold, very sort of sarcastic compere who doesn't really seem to give much of a toss about his guests or his performers. And there's this whole kind of implied thing that he has just booked random acts off the street to come and perform in this theater to fill time. And he, for example, in the early episodes, whenever Miss Piggy tries to sort of come onto him, he will just blatantly insult her. He'll just say, you know, you're a tub of lard or whatever, or make some sarcastic wisecrack. And then, of course, but season three onwards, he is kind of the more sincere kind of hippie Jim Henson-esque frog that we know him as.
A little bit, although he does still retains a little bit of that acerbic edge. I think another thing that I think is very kind of postmodern about the Muppet Show is that part of the entire premise is that the Muppet Show is terrible.
Yeah. You know,
like the ongoing thread of the whole enterprise is that this show is bad, and the acts are generally bad, and Kermit is aware of that. He's sort of aware that he is the producer of this sort of shit, flea-bitten kind of two-bit.
There's a hint of that. Do you remember that film, The Producers, with Gene Wilder?
Yes.
And,
yes, very good.
There's a hint of that across the whole thing, isn't there? The whole premise is they put on this show called Springtime for Hitler. They intentionally put on the worst possible imaginable show, but you get to see a lot of kind of backstage shenanigans in that, but anyway carry on.
But Kermit is obviously yes running a business, you know. I mean, he does have slightly that manner about him. I mean, he is certainly, as Panama Hat mentioned in the early couple of series, he is certainly a very business-like in his relationship to the other Muppets. Also, there is a sort of general neuroticism amongst many of the characters. You know, I mean, there is a lot of pathos, I would say, in the characters of most of the kind of regulars of the show, which is quite curious.
Okay. So who would we want to? I'll just say very quickly. I've always appreciated the slight cynicism of the theatre world. It's something that you can even detect in Shakespeare, right? There's a slight, like, I mean, you know, these wonderful plays, and then you get this slight cynicism that creeps in the epilogues. Oh, you enjoy the show. Come again. You know, we're delighted to have you. Make sure you pay your money for next time type thing. And there is always that, you know, even with Shakespeare, there is that side to the theatre world, which is, reflected in the Kermit character. Okay, do you want to move on to someone else?
Yeah. Also, just before we go, there's an image called Jim Henson Kermit that you pull up. That's sort of behind the scenes image. Yeah. So that's Henson. If people haven't seen Jim Henson before, you know, he was very much of he was a very sort of nerdy kid as far as I can tell, and then you know he sort of was a kind of prototypical hippie type fellow, but he's very much his sort of personality and his way of doing things is very much sort of tied up in this entire enterprise and in many of these characters. But I mean, he was also again a very astute businessman. He basically started from nothing and built up a massively valuable empire over the course of just, you know, 20, 30 years. So a really interesting figure. And I think it was perceptive to sort of compare him to Walt Disney and to George Lucas in that regard.
Okay, who else?
So the next is Rolf the dog, and there's a file called Rolf the dog there.
Now, originally, AA, as you probably know, there was going to be that Mr. D and I were going to give you our top 10 lists of Muppets. And it immediately was clear that everybody's number one was actually going to be Rolf the dog as a sort of firm favorite. And Mr. D, do you want to sort of start as to why Rolf the dog is so popular?
Well, Rolf the dog he and Kermit were the two characters that predated the Muppet Show by a very long time. So I think he came about in 1962, and as Panama Hat said, he was created for a dog food advert that Henson was commissioned to do. And as you mentioned this morning, I think, Panama Hat, that Rolf was actually the character that was closest to Henson's personality. I don't know where that factoid came from, but I would certainly agree with that. You would think that Kermit would be the character most identified with Henson, but apparently Rolf the dog. And there is something, we were talking about the fact that most of the Muppet characters are not competent at what they do.
No.
So, like, if you think about them Kermit is not very good as a compare, as a stage manager. You know, Miss Piggy is a terrible singer. Awful. You know, the Swedish Chef is a terrible cook. You know, Bunsen Honeydew, a beaker. Fozzie is a bad comedian. Gonzo fails at every stunt that he does. You know, they're all kind of terrible. But the two oases of competence are Rolf the dog and the Electric Mayhem, the band, which we'll talk about in a moment. So I think Rolf is actually quite good at playing the piano. Many of the kind of numbers are centered around Rolf accompanying like the guest star or playing things on his own. He plays classical music, he plays and sings songs on his own. There's just something, I don't know how you would describe his character, Hat.
I was going to bring this up is because something that really, really drew me into the Muppet Show was how pinpoint accurate the characterization of each of the Muppets are. Is that they're so perfectly put together in terms of like how they come across. And I mean, you can sort of almost tell just by the way he looks, but he is not the sort of archetypal rocker hippie that was popular at the time the show was running. He is clearly a generation or perhaps a generation or two behind that. I mean, I think he's most probably like sort of a Fats Waller character. You know, he's this sort of big rumpled bag of fur that plays the piano very well. And there's an episode where the Electric Mayhem and all the kind of cool rockers go on strike because they don't like how old Hat the show is. And Rolf is the only one that's, because he's not a part of that. He doesn't care. He's just in it to play the piano. So he stays on, and the outro, which is normally done by the full orchestra with the Electric Mayhem and everything, it's just him. It's just him and the conductor in the orchestra pit as he plays the outro theme. And it's just, I think his character is just, again, they're all good, but his is just incredible, just perfect as this sort of aging piano player.
And also, he's a very simple puppet. I mean, again, he's not, you know, his mouth is articulated, and that's it. His eyes are fixed. He's basically a sort of giant fabric bag with hands, you know. And yet he is very expressive. I mean, you know, it's very impressive how Jim Henson is able to, you know, to sort of make a really sort of character that you can actually kind of latch onto out of such a simple puppet. And I think that's sort of one thing that, that was so appealing about many of the Muppets. Rolf is also notable in that there are different kinds of Muppets. So many of them, like Kermit, are just a single, almost kind of a sleeve where you put your hand up and you just operate it. And then the Kermit's flippers or his little hands are operated by two rods. So a single person can sort of operate Kermit and Gonzo or something like that. But there's a few Muppets like Rolf and the Swedish Chef and Bunsen Honeydew and such, in which two people have to operate them. So in the case of Rolf, it would have been Henson who operated the mouth and one of the hands, and then another puppeteer would have his hand in Rolf's other hand, which is sort of basically like a glove. And so he required actually two people to manipulate when he was playing the piano. And they took great pains to kind of make the fingering on the piano sort of match up to reality. You know, when you see Rolf playing the piano, he is sort of basically hitting the notes, or at least hitting close enough that the illusion is quite convincing. So, but yeah, I mean, again, a simple character, but I think, you know, always been my favorite character for some reason. He's a very sort of sympathetic character, more so than Kermit.
And he also seems to have served as the inspiration for the BBC career of Jules Holland, from your description.
Well, I mean, Rolf actually plays tunes on his own. He doesn't sort of play piano over the top of other people's songs.
Yeah. Also, there's another file there called just Rolf. If you look at that, I mean, again, you know, he seems to have a different expression on his face, even though there's a bit of concern there, just pensive quality. And, you know, there's nothing that's changed. His eyes don't move. You know, it's all in, you know, in the kind of skill of operating this simple puppet. Yeah. So Rolf is certainly a favorite. And I would say Kermit and Rolf are two of the kind of sort of the OG Muppets.
Yes. And they're both, I think, D and I's. Well, I mean, we had to do Kermit first because he's sort of, you know, the Muppet. Yeah. But I mean, we both, as we've said, Rolf is basically our favourite character. I mean, as you brought up Mr. Jules Holland, AA, I mean, if I had to watch an hour of Jules Holland or an hour of Rolf, I would choose Rolf every time.
Okay, who are we going to do next?
Should we do Fozzie?
No, Statler and Waldorf.
Statler and Waldorf, all right.
Yeah, so you'll see a file there. So I put them number three because they, like Rolf and Kermit, are in every episode. I believe that Rolf, Kermit, and Statler Waldorf are the only Muppets who are in every single episode. And so, of course, as we mentioned, these are the two characters that sit in their box seat and basically make fun of the show, heckle, talk about how terrible it is. Yeah. And yet they're there every week. I mean, and they make mention of that. Like, in fact, in the theme song, why do we always come here? I guess we'll never know. It's like a kind of torture to have to watch the show. There is a sort of in-joke about the fact that they attend every performance of this show, and yet they hate it so much. Yeah. And they don't know why they're there.
were they meant to be a kind of gentle cipher of, just a gentle parody of Roger Ebert and his partner? Because they were quite big at the time.
I don't think so.
I think they predated Ebert and Siskel, who I think were an 80s phenomenon.
Yeah. And I mean, Siskel and Ebert, I mean, these two don't offer any real criticism. They just sort of yell insults and bad jokes from the box. It's not sort of a critical thing.
Yeah. Their criticism, there is no criticism. It's just insults.
Bad jokes.
Yeah. Yeah. They appear in the show occasionally. There's a few times where they actually appear on the stage wearing boater hats and pinstripe suits and doing song and dance. There's an episode where Statler is backstage trying to have a romantic interlude with one of the guest stars. I don't remember who it was.
Yeah, and there's also an implication that Statler, which by the way is the one on the right in this, he went on a date with, who was it, the
oh, Lionel Barrymore. Yes, there's a weird joke about it. No, I went with Lionel Barrymore.
Yeah, this weird implication several times that he may be a friend of Dorothy. But you know,
well, they do have wives, these two, because they mention their wives, and you actually see their wives, who of course are just them with women's clothes on. You know, so they do have wives. They're named after. They're named after hotels, of course, the Waldorf Astoria and the other hotel I don't know about.
Statler Hilton, I think,
in New York. So, but yeah, they are sort of the old guard. Like,
he looks a bit like G.K. Chesterton, doesn't he? The on the left.
Now that you've said that, I'm never going to be able to unsee it.
Chesterton watching the Muppet Show. So. So those are with Kermit and Rolf as the kind of the stalwarts of the show.
Okay, who next?
So next, I think Fozzie, as Panama Hat said.
Oh, now this is, I mean, Fozzie Bear is probably the only character that just by appearing has me and I think the rest of the Muppets Hour crew just howling with laughter just by the way he looks. I mean, he is this. You probably couldn't do it today because of the accusations you'd get, but he is this obviously Jewish borscht belt comedian. And now, people don't know what the borscht belt, it was this whole kind of Jewish inner city kind of slum comedy circuit, you know, where these kind of really obnoxiously Jewish stereotype people would go out and perform their comedy to other Jews. And this is the origin of sort of the Jewish humor would come from these borscht belt comedians. And that's what he is. And he has that really zany voice as well, you know, with his, you know, just, and one other detail, I don't know if Mr. D's included a picture of it here, but he frequently takes off his hat as sort of a gesture. And the top of his head, despite the fact that he is furry because he's a bear, the top of his head is clearly meant to be bald. It's got fur on it, but it's got the shape of a
Has a pointed bald head, even though he has fur. So, yeah, the borscht belt comedy. I mean, it came out of the tradition of Yiddish theater, as far as I know. But he is very clearly meant to be that type of comedian. He's of course absolutely terrible. I mean, his jokes are awful.
Yeah.
But yet he is very endearing. He's another favorite character of mine. And again, I mean, he's one of those characters that is sort of imbued with a lot of pathos. I mean, he's tragic, isn't he? Yes, he's a kind of tragic character because he also doesn't necessarily seem to understand that he's so bad. Like you would say the character doesn't know that he's a terrible comedian. He has a kind of confidence, but it's a very brittle confidence, and he's frequently sort of in a kind of slight crisis because of that. And that's also the theme of his interaction.
To what extent do you think that this character inspired Martin Scorsese's King of Comedy?
I don't know about
possibly.
That.
Possibly.
They're all part of that continuum. They are part of the same kind of continuum.
Or even more indirectly, the Joker.
Well, I don't know about that. But I mean,
Joker mode.
one thing to note about him is that, as we mentioned before with the heckling, whenever Fozzie comes out to do a little stand-up routine, he will just be heckled into oblivion by Statler and Waldorf. They will be the ones doing the jokes because they'll lead him around by the nose.
Yeah, he's often one of the only characters who's heckled off the stage, you know.
he's that bad.
And yet he persists. Yes, he makes this noise when he will do one of his jokes. I'm going to do the noise. He often makes this noise where he will do one of his jokes and he will go, "Ah!" and take off his hat, you know. And I mean, he's an amazing character. And
what I love about that, because I may even do a whole deepest lore on this one day is the 70s comedians, the British ones. They all have that nervous kind of you know, they've got their own their own little quirk to cover up just in case the audience don't laugh.
And so here's
Fozzie's got that as well, hasn't he?
Yes, here's some deep lore for you, AA. I watched that stream you did long ago where you were watching that this British movie. I watched that live when it was on. That may have been one of the first times I'd watched anything of yours, strangely enough. So I don't know how I came across that, but
that was a very small crowd, because that wasn't even on this channel.
Very much in that tradition. Yes, I mean the kind of just painful, forced. You know, laugh at my jokes. You know,
this may be a little bit harsh, given how well respected this man seems to be. But I got major Fozzie the Bear vibes from the Spike Milligan episode of The Muppet Show, because Spike Milligan, basically, he appears to me like a living Fozzie the Bear. I just didn't find any of his jokes funny, but he just had that whole thing of, like, he's almost forcing you to laugh just by his, like, energy. He's just... like he's just constantly doing this sort of taking off his hat and jumping around, and you know the jokes are sort of never ending machine gun.
Well, Fozzie is also, again, I mean, I hate to keep using the word postmodern, but I mean he is a hilarious comedian who is funny because he isn't funny. You know, like his comedy is the fact that he's not funny at all, which is sort of curious, and it's a bit like the Steve Martin kind of anti humor. You know,
I mean, he's also from a world that interests me, which is that, I mean, this is both in New York and in Hollywood. You know, you mentioned now, obviously, both of those entertainment industries, both Hollywood and the theaters in New York, have a strong kind of Jewish connection, whether they're the acts or the producers. A lot of them happen to be Jewish for whatever reason. But there's the kind of Broadway, there's the main, and there's the A-list Hollywood. But one of the scenes that's always interested me is the fringe, is the off, is the ones who haven't quite made it. The, you know, it's the B movies in Hollywood, the kind of what do they call them, the Skint Row studios. And there's the same thing in New York, where, you know, it's kind of off Broadway, the seedy little club, the, you know, people just kind of scraping a living somehow.
Yeah.
I was just saying, there's something that I have always found something interesting, and you know, I like to know more about those strange little spaces for some reason.
Well, yeah, I mean, and then that's very much embedded in the whole concept of the show. I mean, all of these characters are, you know, except with a couple of exceptions. But yes, they all are of this world. I mean, this is a terrible, you know, third-rate little flea pit theater. And these people are all these sort of miserable, desperate kind of, you know, yes, desperate hangers-on, like Fozzie.
Yeah, and I mean, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say that I feel like, again, with the Disneyfication of everything, some aspect of that is lost. Like, even if you go to London now, right? Because there was a London equivalent of that as well, of course, going back. But because all of the major shows now are uber-duber kind of Disney-sponsored, we will rock you, all of this kind of, you know, the hyper-Disneyfied musical, for example, the sort of thing that would have been on in those theatres is now pushed to the next rung. And so it's like these strange little spaces that we're talking about are almost no longer, they're almost no longer there, in a way, which is kind of sad. You know, it's like this...
Yeah.
This whole fringe little world no longer seems to be there. Or if you do go there, it will be occupied by some, you know, late 90s comedian, probably, you know. So
yeah, that's true. I mean, the Muppet Show, even that, there's some sort of debate over where exactly the Muppet Theater is meant to be.
Right.
And some people think it's in Britain, and some think it's in America, or where exactly it is in America. But, I mean, if you take away the American voices, then this could be, you know, some regional theater in somewhere in the United Kingdom, just not London, you know, some regional town with a theater like this, in a different sort of age. So, I mean, yeah, it does have that vibe. And I think you're right, AA, that it's very difficult to really come by this sort of thing anymore. Whereas at one time, this would have been everywhere. Every town in the country would have had a tiny little theater with all these sort of people who are either trying to make it and they haven't got there yet, or they were something and now they've fallen back to this level. You know, that's the... That was the conceit.
Yeah, and I feel like what happened with a lot of those is that they kind of went over to pantomime.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I remember, because there was one such theatre in the town that I grew up, and I remember the town abuzz one week when Harold Bishop from Neighbours was coming to town, because he was going to be in the panto, you know.
Yeah. Well, you kind of see that.
But even that space has got a remnant of it. You know, the idea of Les Dennis playing Buttons or something like this has got that slight tragedy, but it's not quite the same, is it? Somebody who's like going around, I don't know, juggling eggs or whatever as their,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
There's a disappeared tradition as well. I mean, I don't know how many people know this, but even in the 70s in Britain, so, you know, when they have these sort of comedies, like I'm thinking of like Are You Being Served, and so they would, you know, they would do the show, and then during the summer or during the sort of off season, the cast of the show would tour around to these theaters that we're talking about, and they would do a stage version of the show. I mean, this was again this age where, you know, just because you were on television didn't mean that you didn't have to constantly work to be able to sort of support yourself, you know. These weren't people sort of, you know, until later on, sort of getting these huge salaries. I mean, it was still, even into the 70s, there was still this kind of slightly sad aspect to being an actor in that situation. I mean, even television actors. So
the pay was not
and many of the guest stars on The Muppet Show express sort of disdain at the fact that they've been booked onto this show. There's a lot of jokes like why calling their agent, why have you booked me here, what the hell is this, you know. Yeah. Get me out of here. You know, there is this sense that they know that they're in this sort of shit theater.
Do you know what else was kind of slightly amusing to me is I noticed that some of the bookings were you know, I'm a big fan of WWF wrestling, right? Which was in New York, you know, based in New York, and the office was up there. Of course, for the first WrestleMania, Liberace was booked. And a lot of the acts that crop up in the Muppet Show were also the sorts of stars who'd be booked onto wrestling supercards, you know, as a kind of celebrity. And I'm just kind of amused by that.
Liberace was a guest on the Muppet Show.
Yeah, right? And
that may be one of our least favorite episodes.
We all hated it unanimously because it's just like normally the guests are actually not even in the episode at all. Like they appear at the start and they do like one or two sort of acts on their own, and then they appear at the end and that's it. Most of the show is taken up with sort of Muppet antics. But Liberace has about just, you know, 20 minutes of a half an hour show to himself.
He does a 15 minute like number, you know.
He probably demanded it. He was probably like, I'm not coming on this unless you give me like serious time, you know. There was another star like that I noticed who cropped in. What was his name? I'd never heard of him, but I kind of spent a little while reading his Wikipedia, trying to find his name now. Spent something. Let me have a look.
Just while you're looking for that, I would say I'm really glad you brought up that that play, The Entertainer, and the really, really depressing film of it, because there's that scene in that where the main character has been doing a sort of Fozzie the Bear shtick all day, and he sort of built himself up. You know, he's still got it. He's still, you know, the musical tradition. He's keeping it alive. And then he goes out there, and the curtains open, and there's like four people in the audience. And he just goes on this rant about the state of everything. I mean, that is basically if Fozzie the Bear was in a sort of melodrama, that would be him. But he's in the Muppets, so he's got to stay somewhat lighthearted.
Something about just the sheer tragedy of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm trying to find that other kind of Liberace caliber star. Some Italian guy. I was like, who is this geezer? I can't find it now. But anyway,
you're not thinking of, is he? You're thinking of a.
Sorry. Signor Wences.
Hang on. Just a minute, AA. Now, Signor Wences. I hadn't heard of Signor Wences before I watched The Muppet Show. And I love that episode because he really endeared himself to me. I loved Signor Wences and his kind
and
of
I'll
really...
tell you,
go on, dude.
There's a reason why Signor Wences is given so much prominence on the show, because he was the person, one of the people who inspired Jim Henson to take up the brand of puppetry that he did.
There he is.
Because he was relentlessly promoted on American television in the 1950s and the 1960s, and so yes, Signor Wences was a direct inspiration to Henson, and so I think that his prominence on the show wasn't a sort of, you know, a consequence of him sort of asking for the time. I mean, he was given the time because Henson loved him so much.
I was very interested by this character and spent quite a bit of, you know, sometimes you kind of disappeared in a rabbit hole. I spent quite a while reading about this chap. So
I do have something of a bias because he looks very similar to my late uncle, who I was very close to. But another thing to note is that you've got to remember that that period in which the show was made, so had a lot of people that were really, really just of another era. I mean, Wences was born in 1896 and he lived till 1999. I mean, and he's coming on this show in the 1970s. I mean, this is a man that you know, remembers like the early part of the last century, and he's on the show.
Well, and talking about the you know, the kind of vaudeville and such, I mean, there are actually quite a number of people who were vaudevillians and who would have been, like, Bob Hope literally did British Music Hall. As I said, he was British. His name was, he was born Leslie, by the way, not Bob. As evidence of his British ancestry. But I mean, you know, George Burns, Milton Berle. I mean, these men, of course, got their start in the very kind of theatre that The Muppet Show was kind of patterned after. So
this is something else that I've always loved, right? I think this is a very difficult thing to put one's finger on, but I have always loved it. Okay, it is the idea of a star very far past their prime, transported to a slightly different context. Okay, I'm thinking like you know, Bela Lugosi in like 1948. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, you see it in wrestling sometimes, like, you know, Dick the Bruiser, you know, 1970s Detroit star transported to like 1990 in WCW. This is the sort of thing I'm talking about, where you've got someone who grew up in a different time and place, and now they're stuck in this, you know, George Sanders cropping up in 60s Batman, you know, it's like...
Orson Welles doing cheap wine commercials.
I mean, Orson Welles, by the way, was in Transformers in the 80s in the cartoon. He voiced
that was his last role, you know, the voice of Optimus Prime. That was his final role in a film. So,
all right.
Probably the most famous example of that is literally Alec Guinness in Star Wars. In Alec Guinness's mind, Star Wars was just like something he was doing. But it just so happened to take off. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is quite wonderful to see a man like Signor Wences on the Muppet Show. I mean, did you not like Signor Wences' kind of like old school wholesomeness, AA?
Oh no, no, I absolutely loved it. But what I was trying to say was that the reason I mentioned Liberace is because he is another one of these people who was kind of a little bit outside of the, you know, a star from a different era, magically transported to the 1970s.
Edgar Bergen was another. He was a guest on the Muppet Show. He was the ventriloquist who did Charlie McCarthy, and so of course his heyday was in the 1930s, doing this ventriloquist act, and here he is in the 70s on a puppet show, basically these very different types of puppets from the one that he was related to, you know, doing his act where. You know, also he may be one of the worst ventriloquists ever. Like, you know, I'm just surprised that he didn't even sort of try not to move his mouth.
Yeah, that was right. I didn't like that. But and also just one last weird fact about Señor Wences before we go. He originally wanted to be a matador, and at the age of 15, he was in the bullring and a bull gored his leg, so he decided to become a ventriloquist instead. pre World War One, remember?
All right.
So that's wonderful. Maybe I'll do a whole show about on a whole deepest lore on that very specific phenomena of the of the star far outside of their heyday.
There's probably a German word for that concept.
We'll have to ask Young Arrive in the deep lore.
I love it. You know, that's why I love The Entertainer by Osborne, because it's just so like. Mm. I mean, that's the tragic dark underheart of it, but. There's just something about that whole. There's a Kink song that gives you the feeling of it called "Celluloid Heroes," where he's literally, you know, it's the likes of a Greta Garbo, but like 20 or 30 years outside of her of her heyday. Okay, carry on, Panama. Sorry.
Well, one other thing that has quite a strong vibe of that is the song. The Manilow song, is it Copacabana? There's that showgirl who goes mad because she's like a 1940s, you know, dance line chorus girl, and she's there in like the 80s when it's a disco, you know, in the corner.
It's
yeah.
like the Sunset Boulevard, you know, the kind of Miss Havisham, you know, this idea of just a person who's trapped in the past in a way.
Yeah, love it. Absolutely love it. We'll have to come back to that
anyway.
That theme, but let's move on from Fozzie.
Okay. Next up, I think Miss Piggy should get a mention. So so you have a file there called Miss Piggy. So Miss Piggy, of course, is I think another one of the most sort of identifiable Muppets. She was interesting because she sort of evolved on the show. If there's another file there called Miss Piggy Early, and if you pop that open,
much more ugly.
So when she first appeared in the first series, that she looked like that. She was had a very different sort of facial type. And she had a different personality. I mean, one thing you notice when you watch the series one episodes, especially the early ones, is that many of the characters hadn't yet developed. They hadn't really figured out what their characters were. Mm-hmm. And all their voices, some of them have very different voices in the beginning of the run. And Miss Piggy is one of those. I mean, she was a very minor character. And suddenly she sort of became kind of one of the most prominent characters due to her strange lust for Kermit the Frog, I would say. I don't like Miss Piggy. I've never liked Miss Piggy as a character. That's beside the point. Now, that's sort of what she evolved into in the course of the 70s. You know, she got a very different facial structure, you know, different eyes, and her personality sort of became much stronger. There's some other pictures there of, like, yes, there she is with Raquel Welch. But sort of her main shtick was that she was in that she yes, Michael Parkinson, yeah.
Give me a pee, please, Bob.
her character was that she was a chanteuse who wasn't very good. She's not a terribly good singer.
Chanteuse, as they say.
Chanteuse. She's a pig. Yeah. I mean, she's literally, you know, like half of the material directed her is about her being fat and being a pig. But yet she sort of fancies herself like this femme fatale, this sort of great glamour, this great glamour star. She pretends to speak French, even though she doesn't actually speak French. And there's many jokes about her not actually being able to speak French in the show. She is obsessed with Kermit, who doesn't really want to have anything to do with her. Like, she sort of is constantly trying to get him to marry her, even sort of trying to trick him into marrying her. But, you know, she is also, again, she's very jealous of any of the female guest stars, hence the thing with Raquel Welch. She's always, if there's a sort of pretty female, you know, singer or something, I mean, Miss Piggy was always used to kind of insert herself in and kind of compete with the guest star. So she has just a very kind of, I don't know, abrasive character, which just
I mean, in some ways, Dee, I was going to say she's a strangely fitting icon of our times, isn't she? I would say that Miss Piggy, in some ways, preempted a lot of the developments that we'd see over the past, you know, since the 1970s. You could say that she served as the inspiration for many an X Factor contestant, for example.
She does have that vibe. Although I will say in favor of Miss Piggy, I wouldn't say I like her, but you're not meant to. Again, as Dee points out, she is deliberately a very abrasive character. And you are meant to be, you're not meant to pity her like you pity kind of Fozzie or any of the sort of, you know, bad ones. She is kind of too obnoxious and too ego driven to be likable, I think. But again, it's part of her. You're not meant to like her.
It does strike me though. Okay, and tell me if you disagree with this, Dee, that there has been, even from Miss Piggy, I say, the fitting icon of our times, there has even been a degeneration from Miss Piggy to the typical guest on Jerry Springer or, in this country, Jeremy Kyle. Because Miss Piggy, you know, as obnoxious as she is, she still has what I would describe as Blanche DuBois pretension. You know, remember in Streetcar Named Desire, there's that kind of slight aspiration of the, you know, slight pretension towards being something better. You know, she tries to speak French. She tries to be more. Whereas by the time you get to the late 90s and you have the equivalent sitting on Jerry Springer, it is screw you guys, I'll do what I want. You know, go girl. You know, so even the attempt at being better is lost by the time you get to the late 90s in the ashes, as it were.
Right. I mean, you know, she's also, again, she's very much like the rest of them in that she sort of has aspirations far beyond her abilities, but she never, again, she's a bit like Fozzie, even more so than Fozzie, in that she doesn't ever seem to understand that she has these limitations, that she isn't as amazing as she believes herself to be. But they never, in the show, there is, unlike with like Gonzo and Fozzie, she never has a kind of solemn, sincere kind of, you know, sad song where you're meant to feel sorry for her. I don't think in any of the episodes she is ever made sympathetic in that way. Like, she is always sort of held up as a figure of fun in a way, and you certainly never get this. I mean, in fact, I don't think you couldn't make fat jokes and pig jokes and things about a character like that on a current, you know, current show, especially one sort of directed towards children in a way.
There's also you couldn't have a female character like this who has a very clear beauty inferiority thing going on with sort of all the attractive female guest stars they have on, who are very, you know, by the standards of the current year, are outrageously traditional in their femininity. You know, like look at Raquel Welch. I mean, Piggy will, you know, go to absurd lengths to kind of bring down these guest stars because they're more attractive than her, and that's it.
She also assaults people. She also assaults people. Like, she's physically very violent. Assaults people. Yeah, she's very violent. Many people she hits, including the guest stars. She beats Kermit. I mean, she literally commits domestic violence against Kermit all the time. She does a karate chop. There she is with Mark Hamill. So she's a very strange character, and also, again, strange that she's become such a kind of a mainstay of this image. Now, of course, I don't know what they're doing with her. As I said, I have no interest in what the Muppet franchise is now, but I suspect she's a body positivity icon. I suspect that's what...
Well, exactly. They stick her on the front of Vogue and they say, you know, Miss Piggy...
Oh, she has been. But the thing is, no, she was on the covers of kind of major publications of the time as a joke. Like she appeared on the cover of Vogue and on, you know, all these sorts of fashion publications because it was funny. It was taking the piss. You know, if she appeared on it now, as you say, it would be as an icon. It wouldn't be as a joke.
And if you look up her appearance now, I mean, you don't have to do this, but they've also changed her appearance quite drastically. And they've given her that kind of look, that vapid, just sort of
Disney-fied.
Yeah, that's more than Disney. It's just that sort of like contemporary female celebrity look that I think it's just so unappealing. I don't know. They've done something with her face that just makes her look like she's had cosmetic surgery or something.
The ears are larger.
There we go.
It's not good. It's not good.
All right, so let's move on to someone else.
So next is, I would say, Gonzo. Yeah. Another character.
There he is. Right. Now, look, you can see there, I think this is from an earlier episode of The Muppet Show, because in the early episodes, Gonzo has a very, very different character in that you don't actually know what his real acts are. You don't know what his talent is supposed to be. All you know is that he looks very moth-eaten and, as you can see, very sort of run down, and he is completely pathetic. He fails at everything. He's rarely allowed to actually go on the stage, and he has this kind of, his voice is still kind of that croaky voice that he has later on, but it's really sad, and kind of the implication is that he's old and sort of washed up, and that he's just he's at the bottom of the ladder completely. You know, he's really just utterly at the end of his tether. And later on, they kind of tweak the character, and he's more upbeat, and he's more sort of just they up the kind of weirdness. I don't think it's bad that they did that. That they were just aiming for something a bit different, I think, with his character.
Yeah, he starts out as a very, I mean, talk about pathos. I mean, he is the most pathos ridden Muppet of all of them, certainly at the beginning. I mean, he's depressing. And you also don't know what he is. I mean, another one of the jokes is not only, you know, is he just this sort of moth-eaten non-entity, but even like what he actually is as a creature isn't really specified, and they make jokes about that as well. There is a deep pathetic streak to Gonzo that I think makes him quite appealing. And as we said later on in the show, he develops this a different kind of persona. Interestingly enough, the puppeteer, who's called Dave Goals, I think, originally started on the show in the first series working in the shop building puppets, and he was sort of asked to participate as a performer in a minor way, and he was very self-conscious because he'd never done any kind of puppeteering and such, and so he actually used Gonzo as a kind of way to kind of work through his feelings of kind of inferiority and lack of confidence. And as he kind of goes on, he kind of made Gonzo into this impervious kind of character that just foolhardy would rush into anything and do anything without fear, without worrying about what was going to happen to himself. So in that sense, I think he's most sort of actually tied to this idea of the performer himself kind of using Gonzo to work through something, you know, in his own personality.
I mean, in fairness to him, right, if you're ever going to feel inferior, you've never done any puppetry before, and you're literally working with Jim Henson. It's just like...
Yeah. Yeah. So if you open up the file called Gonzo Motorbike... So sort of as Gonzo evolved, he basically became a kind of stunt performer. His act would often be him doing something very dangerous or very weird or both, and inevitably failing at it. You know, like this his act, he was meant to drive this motorbike up a ramp and land in Statler and Waldorf's box, which of course he didn't do, you know, without incident. But he became this kind of overconfident but completely inept stunt performer as his character evolved.
Like Eddie the Eagle.
Kind of, but he's a lot more pathetic than Eddie the Eagle, if that's possible. And he also develops this bizarre thing where he has a fetish for chickens.
And, yes, there's a file called Gonzo and Chickens, yes.
Yeah, here we are. I mean, also, this is one of those weird shots where you can see the Muppet's legs, which never really looks right to me. And we actually saw an episode just this morning in which he's shown sort of as a full character, but he's tiny and his legs are about 2 inches long, and he's just sort of sat on the floor in a corner, a tiny little creature.
Yeah, but he does. Yeah, he develops what is quite clearly a sexual fetish for chickens. Mm. He's sexually interested in chickens. The weirdness factor of Gonzo, I think, gets played up as he kind of develops as a character. There is a chicken called Camilla, who sort of appears very late. In fact, she may be post Muppet Show as his kind of almost girlfriend. But yes, there's lots of chickens. One thing we should mention is that there were a few animals who were just for some reason prominently featured in many episodes of the Muppet Show. So pigs, of course, appear a lot. Penguins appear a lot, and chickens. There are many, many, many sketches involving chickens doing things, playing the piano, singing. The chickens, strangely enough, most of the shows don't have the power of speech. They can only sort of cluck, which is odd. There does seem to be this kind of system of castes of Muppets. So there are some Muppets that they're more realistic. You know, they look more like the animals that they're meant to be, and they can't speak, you know. So it is very odd that there's certain pigs in the show that you see occasionally that are just like regular pigs. They don't speak, they don't wear clothes. And then there's other pigs. It's like Animal Farm a bit, you know. some of them ended up sort of taking on humanoid characteristics and some didn't. But the chickens are a bit like that. Most of the time the chickens can't actually speak.
Yeah, I saw one where the Swedish chef was... with a chicken who was laying eggs, and then he was bouncing them off the table.
I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot to mention, by the way, I also happened to see the Roger Moore episode Roger Moore has a lot of awkward scenes with Miss Piggy, which are quite funny to watch. Cause I mean, he was literally James Bond at the time. And she's coming on to him and he's not really having much of it.
Now, this is something I feel I should bring up now that you mentioned Roger Moore, which is that some of the guest stars on The Muppet Show, some of them are kind of like Roger Moore, have enough self-awareness and can kind of take the piss out of themselves enough to kind of get into... to really make a good episode of the show. You know, they're aware of the sort of thing it is, and they just want to have a bit of a laugh with the characters on the show. And you get some guests like Liberace, who we mentioned, who they're just there to promote themselves. They just want to show off and then go. Yeah.
He treated it as another booking, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes,
some guests are very good. Like, they're just very good at interacting. They speak to them. Like, you'll actually see that there are some guests who are clearly looking at the puppeteers, they're not looking at the puppets. Yeah. And then there's other guests that just seem to be very natural and engage with the Muppets just as if they're actors or you know, sort of characters. And I think the shows that are kind of regarded as the best episodes are the ones with people who, you know, who are just very good at interacting with the Muppets characters.
I noticed Elton John was extremely natural with the Muppets.
Well, he's almost like a big Muppet himself. I mean, he plays Crocodile Rock, and he's literally like dressed in feathers and felt. He looks just like one of them.
Very bizarre. And of course, there's also. I mean, I was going to say Elton John. I found with him, it wasn't so much that he gelled with the Muppets as just he. he played it completely straight. And but of course, because he's Elton John, it works. Like, he, as Dee said, he may as well be a Muppet. Like, he's just that sort of person.
Yeah, I didn't mean the actual musical numbers, which were, because I mean that episode is almost like a kind of Elton John rock concert, because he does about four or five numbers. I was talking about the scenes backstage where he's just chilling out and having a conversation with literally Kermit and a bunch of Muppets, as if he's just talking to his mate.
Yeah,
those are the scenes I'm talking about. Yeah,
yeah. There's a number of guest stars who do that. I mean, another one I remember always is Pearl Bailey, who was a jazz blues singer and comedian. You know, and she, I remember her doing a scene in the dressing room with Floyd, one of the musician Muppets, at like doing a kind of duet, like with scat singing, and it's so good because it's just like two people interacting, you know. So yeah, some people are very on with it, you know, very very naturally interact with the Muppets, and then some, you know, you can see that it's a more stilted interaction, shall we say.
Can I play a little game while we've still got time? Just very quickly on Gonzo. Am I right in thinking that he also crops up in Sesame Street? I seem to remember he's another crossover. He's also in Sesame Street, right?
Yeah, quite a number of them do that. I mean, there are crossovers, and the Sesame Street characters occasionally appear on the Muppet Show. I mean, there's at least two or three episodes where Bert and Ernie and others from Sesame Street, you know, sort of make the crossover. So,
So I just wanted to name some stars, right? And you just tell me very quickly how well they interacted, okay? How did Charles Aznavour get on? Because he was
very well.
Oh, Charles Aznavour, yes. He I think he, as far as I recall, yeah, he did very well.
Friendly uncle. I just want to say quickly with Aznavour, it's another type of performer where normally they're quite old and they do a kind of like, it's kind of like an old granddad talking to his you know, young kids. That's what it felt like, you know, sort of a grandfatherly figure.
What about Peter Ustinov? How did he get on?
Pretty well. It's been a while since we've seen that one.
That was one we watched a long time. But yeah, I would say that he did, you know, he was another one that was pretty good.
How did Brucey get on? I actually watched this episode, the Bruce Forsyth one. What did you think?
Again, even then, quite sort of grandfatherly. You know, he's just sort of this sweet guy that treats them up as if they were real people. And so he just sort of plays it straight like that, so it works.
I couldn't help but notice, though, that Brucey sings in a 1950s crooner manner.
Do you think that's what he wanted to be?
Hmm.
Okay. Let's. What about Vincent Price? How did he get on?
Oh, very well. That's a very well regarded episode, and there's a lot of funny moments in that. I mean, at one point, Kermit kind of turns into a vampire and lunges at Vincent Price's neck in a very alarming way. And yeah, I think the Vincent Price episode is another favorite of people. Also, if you see from that, you know, the list of images, the one called Alice Cooper Piggy, that was another show that a very strange crossover, but again, a very natural kind of interaction.
And another person who was booked by Vince McMahon, of course, is Alice Cooper. there we go. What about Twiggy? Famous in my mind for appearing on the front of pinups.
We just watched that today. By Bowie.
Yeah.
I was very underwhelmed. I mean, she doesn't do very much, and I mean, this is sort of past her modeling days. So she doesn't show off any skin or anything. She's quite, you know, buttoned up, which is, you know, I still prefer that to the sort of lurid costumes of modern female stars. The trouble is, she's, again, this just feels sort of cruel because I don't really know much about Twiggy, but she doesn't seem to be much of an actress or very talented of a singer. I mean, she can sing, but it's not anything special. So I think that she's there because she was a big name, but she doesn't She didn't do.
Yeah, I thought she was a bit. She was a bit stilted. Her interactions were a bit stilted, and it just seemed to be kind of the limitations of her kind of versatility as a performer. You know,
she's just a model, wasn't she, Twiggy?
Yeah,
and in fact, her first number in the show is this weird kind of thing where she sings the Beatles. There are places I remember, you know, that all my life, and some have changed. She sings that, and then they show kind of images from her modeling career. Like, this is this very, very sort of melancholy, nostalgic moment where she's reviewing her, you know, her long life. She was probably like 25 years old when the show aired. But
how did Johnny? All right, of all the stars, Johnny Cash. Huge star to appear on there. Have you seen that episode there?
Yes, and he was again another one that did very well. I mean, a person you wouldn't expect, you know, given his just biography and the type of man that he was. But he does very well, and also because there's a very strong kind of country music element on a lot of the shows. It's clear that Jim Henson was very much like many people, certainly Americans at that time, very into bluegrass and kind of, you know, kind of a lot of the people forget that a lot of kind of hippie guys in the 60s sort of really got into kind of American sort of roots folk and bluegrass and country and such. So yeah, that I felt that Johnny Cash was quite a natural fit.
I very much enjoyed it. Yeah.
And I mean, I'm just having a look at some of the unusual people who. Well, Debbie Harry was on the Muppet Show.
Yes, Debbie Harry is on the Muppet Show. But I will say, to the eternal shame, that none of the kids who watched the show knew who she was.
Oh, come on.
Adam did not know who she was.
I can't remember who she is now.
you don't know who Debbie Harry is?
Looking her up on Wikipedia as we speak.
Come on.
What was
Blondie,
she
for God's sake.
Blondie, she was, yes.
Blondie. My God.
Never listened to Blondie.
Dear me. I've always thought that that she looks a bit like Michelle Pfeiffer, by the way. But anyway. What about Gene Kelly? He's a pretty... I mean, this is the weird thing, right? Gene Kelly and Debbie Harry were on the same... on the same show, like within the space of a few episodes. How did he get on?
Well, he got on. His shtick on the show was that he was just visiting to watch the show, and he wasn't there to perform. And so, like, most of the show, he sort of is basically his numbers are him being goaded into or tricked into performing. And they finally have this entire setup for him to do Singing in the Rain at the end, and he doesn't do it. He just kind of walks through it, the set, and it's a really kind of nice moment the way they pull that off. But yeah, I mean, he seemed to get on quite well, you know, as well. Yeah, I mean,
Diana Ross was on the show.
Diana Ross, yes, a little less interactive, I would say, with the Muppets, but.
Not surprising. She famous in this country, of course, for you know, as well as being a huge star, for also doing the worst penalty kick of all time in the 1994 World Cup. Do you remember that?
Can't say that I do.
There's footage of Diana Ross in the opening ceremony of the 1994 World Cup. She's meant to like shoot a penalty and score a goal, and it just goes massively wide, and it's just one of the worst. You can tell she's never even thought about kicking a football before in her entire life. What about Christopher Reeve, Superman? He turns up at one point.
Yeah, well, I didn't show them that episode yet. Okay. But we haven't watched that officially, but yeah.
Sliced Alone? So.
I thought he was... We didn't watch that one yet either, but I mean, I have watched it. I think he's a bit weak. He's very clearly not sure what he's doing there.
One thing I would just say at this point, given the variety of stars as you pointed out, is that I think part of the reason you couldn't do the Muppet Show today is because the 70s were an era in which you could still get all these kind of old style tuxedo wearing singers and sort of classically trained actors and crooners and all the like and entertainers. And at the same time, you could have Alice Cooper and Elton John, who were kind of heralding the 80s yet to come. You know, you were I think it was a very, very choice moment in history to make a show like this.
Well, there was very much a trope of that. I mean, you remember like Bing Crosby and David Bowie, you know, performing together.
Whereas now, what would the crossover even be?
Rappers and like soul singers,
and probably Paul McCartney and Kanye. I think which has happened.
Wouldn't work.
They've done it. No, they did. They did a song together. I suppose that would be it. I don't know.
I guess what I'm saying is we've literally had 25 years of Simon Cowell. No, it's just like
at this point, the music is just a commercial entity. Like the artistry that you had in the set. I mean, don't get me wrong; it was still heavily, you know, commercially run, but the auteurs were still at the front. You know, you had Alice Cooper, as I said, versus, you know, Charles Aznavour. You know, even though they were two completely different worlds from years apart, they still both could respect each other on the level. They were both kind of independent artists who did their own thing. And nowadays, it's all just the same slushy, girly-voiced sort of people that you hear blared on the radio in shops and in taxis and things.
Yeah. Well, you'd also get, in the Muppet Show, you get classical people. I mean, so, of course, Beverly Sills, who was the director of the Metropolitan Opera in New York for a very long time, and an opera singer, a soprano. I mean, she comes on and does, like, something they do a number called Pigoletto.
I love that, by the way. Brilliant. And
Jean-Pierre Rampal, a very famous flutist, who is basically responsible for kind of bringing the flute back as a kind of major instrument, and bringing a lot of flute concertos and such back from the dead. He's on there, and he plays the Pied Piper, who's called by rats, these German rats, these Bavarian rats, to get children, to lead the children out of, because they're eating their homes. So he literally plays the Pied Piper and leads the children away.
Victor Borger, who plays, you know, all sorts of classical along with his comedy.
It is the sheer range, though. I mean, I'm just looking. I mean, it's, you know, you mentioned Bob Hope and Peter Sellers and John Cleese turning up, but then it's like literally like Kris Kristofferson, Leo Sayer. I still can't get over that. You know, Liberace, and then it's like, and then within a couple of episodes, like literally Sly Stallone, and then and then you've got people like Dudley Moore crops up, Arlo Guthrie, Kenny Rogers. I mean, these are people from completely different worlds. Kind of Mark Hamill, Andy Williams, another 50s crooner. And then Gene Kelly, we mentioned. Shirley Bassey crops in for an episode.
Yeah, and her finale is she sings Goldfinger at the end. So.
Yeah.
Gladys Knight, Marty Feldman. I mean, these are people from wildly contrasting different worlds, all in the space of like about five or six episodes. It is really something, isn't it?
And you would never get it. It would just not happen today.
And on top of that, you've got zany, like old hat sketch comedy full of one-liners and sort of, you know, random character moments from the Muppets. It's quite bizarre.
Yeah, we should hopefully we can touch on that quickly.
Now, I've got a funny feeling, folks, that we're going to run out of time here because of our delayed start. I'm going to have to go soon for AAA because Mrs. A has got an engagement. Mm. So we may have to come back and do a part two.
Muppets part two.
There's going to have to be a part two because there's so much to cover.
Yeah.
And it's actually really, and it may even give me a chance to watch a bit more as well. So
we'll see if people like, I mean, if people liked it, I don't know.
I've very much enjoyed this.
I'm going to hit the super chat, and then I think that we will to be continued on this, because definitely worth doing. So I'm going to have a look at the super chats. There's been a few. Mangalisa Shan says Gorman Hast is life. Household Dog says Bika was single-handedly responsible for the 90s rave scene.
Was he?
Christian Chad says, I love the Muppets Christmas Carol, and this Christmas I hope to enjoy it with a warm cup of coffee in a new Nescafe Gold Standard mug. The best of Austrian, the best of Austrian econ and good coffee. Jedi Knight Anakin Cringewalker says, "When I was 8, I discovered some of my favorite neighbors on Sesame Street were in this strange film called The Muppet Movie. Thus began a rabbit hole of searching how many universes these characters are in." Yeah, absolutely. Red Hammerhead says, "Steve Turley's guitar skills are better than his shilling skills. Can't post the link. Video is called Steve Turley Performs for the 700 Club." Yeah, I mean, one of the things I love about that is that there's an incredible David Brent vibe to that. Thug Life Bear says, "I'm here." Yeah, thank you very much. Hollow 1960. Hollow 1916 says, "Statler and Waldorf are my favorites. They embody the perfidious Albion." Lol.
They aren't Anglo, though. They seem to be American.
Yeah.
I would say that the one who looks like G.K. Chesterton is Anglo, and the other one is probably Jewish. But
they really don't sound it, though. They do have
very specific American accents, but anyway.
But his name is Waldorf. I mean, is that not...
Well, after the Waldorf Astoria, which is a hotel in New York City. I mean, that's what he's named after.
Jedi Knight Anakin Cringewalker says, "Miss Piggle predisposed me to avoid feminists. When I hit puberty and thought to ask someone out, I'd ask, will this cause me to end up like Kermit?" DRT is King says, "Sad news. Razorfist has been yeeted from Twitter and Facebook. The Oracle of Phoenix has been silenced by Silicon Valley." I'm sure that will be reversed by Twitter, but let's see. Owen Kapler says, "With all the talk of postmodernism, I'm expecting Jordan Peterson to come on and talk about Henderson bankrupting people of real personal responsibility."
Well, there would have to be a reference to George, you know, to Peterson because of the voice, you know.
The Marxism and the postmodernists are coming together. It's the bloody Marxists, you know.
Sort of you have to defeat the Dragon of Chaos.
Personal responsibility. Hi, ho, welcome to the Muppet Show.
To be fair to Peterson, he does own a Kermit little Kermit hand puppet, and he has appeared with it before. So
I think it's safe to say that we have merely scratched the surface of the and next time I think on the second show we will go into the obscura and unearth some of the stranger characters. I mean, there's this kind of shrimp fellow who crops up occasionally that I wanted to talk about. But there's a lot of, like, on the Muppet undercard, if you want, a lot of interesting little characters who crop up.
Oh, yes.
We still have a lot to get through.
Yeah, we've got a lot of material related to all that. So.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been excellent. I mean, shall we do... Are you two available next week, or...
Yes, as far as I know.
I think so, yeah.
All right, well, let's the same time next week, we'll do some more Muppets.
Well, we'll hopefully start earlier.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much, everyone. Now get out.